I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and this is Up to Date. The prolific director, actor, producer Woody Allen has put out a movie a year since the mid-1960s. His focus includes relationship metaphors, a romance with the Manhattan skyline, and the nebbish leading man. On today's program, the DVD gurus examine Allen's decades-long career through favorites such as Manhattan and beyond to works like Stardust Memories. We invite you to join the conversation and tell us your favorite Woody Allen film. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. Woody Allen's new film, To Roam with Love, isn't getting the best reviews, but Woody's legacy is pretty secure. Producing a movie a year for nearly four decades, Woody Allen, of course, put out some classic films. To name two, Annie Hall and Manhattan, and that's music from Manhattan we're listening to right now. Today we'll talk about Woody and his career with our DVD gurus, and we'll try to figure out just where he ranks on the list of all-time great American filmmakers. The DVD gurus are Mitch Bryan. He's a screenwriter, UMKC film professor, and columnist for 435 South. Mitch, good to have you.
Great to be here.
And Jason Heck reviews movies for the Kansas City Star. Jason, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks.
How is Woody's new film, To Roam with Love? What's the line here?
Well, Mitch and I
went
did
and saw
kind
it.
Of a bro date and went and caught it. And I would not rank it near the top. I don't think it's awful. I think it's longer than it needs to be. I don't think it's got a great deal. I mean, it tells four very different stories, all set in the Eternal City. And they're kind of intercut sort of needlessly. And I think it wastes a few actors. I think Judy Davis is not utilized to anything like her talents. I didn't love it. Mitch?
Yeah, I'm right there with you. And I wondered sometimes, because there's four stories, that maybe if there had only been three, you know, there was one that sort of really kind of stuck out as being not all that great, maybe then it would have played differently.
Yeah.
But, you know, his movies are always interesting, even when it's kind of a swing and a miss or just a base hit, you know. There's always something going on, and, you know, whether you respond to it as strongly as maybe the last one or not, there's clearly something to watch, and there are always amazing actors, and there's one of the four sequences stories that's hilarious, that deals with Alec Baldwin as this mentor, and then eventually kind of an imagined mentor, not unlike the Bogart character in Play It Again, Sam, who's advising this young guy who's about ready to, you know, destroy his life for love. And he's, you know, Baldwin's hilarious in it. So it's not a film that you can dismiss, you know?
Well, I'm not giving away anything here. I bumped into Bob Butler, one of our movie reviewers at the Hen House just a week or so ago after he was on.
Hen?
He hadn't seen the new Woody when he was here a couple weeks ago, but he had seen it just right after I bumped into him. And he said, you know, not so good. He wasn't crazy about it either.
Does he know that you call Hen House the Hen?
You know, we all call it the Hen.
So like the K,
it's a neighborhood
right?
thing.
Okay.
The K, the Hen.
The mean streets
on,
of
man.
Fairway.
You don't
and
call
Wester.
BP the P, yeah. Do you?
Yeah. Yeah.
But,
so
you know,
gritty.
He makes a movie a year. And this is extraordinary. You think about some of the great studio auteur directors like Howard Hawks, for example, who would go from studio to studio and genre to genre. And in that case, you know, Hawks would come in and he would be this ultimate hired gun. And yeah, he might move a script through a set of revisions and make it. But it was all the infrastructure of the studio system that allowed those guys to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Woody Allen, on the other hand, generates everything, including going out and finding his finance. And he's had to go from one financier to the next and has managed to do that with his production team every single year.
Hey, how big of a trick is it to put a film out a year?
It's unimaginable to me.
Really?
I mean, in the sense that he's, you know, like they say, as soon as he's done editing, he's immediately writing the next one. He writes very quickly. He's able to get pretty much anybody he wants to be in the cast. He's got an infrastructure built into for himself of how they make these movies. Granted, he's making movies differently now because he's gone to Europe and is making films there. But it's an extraordinary thing. And how old is the guy now? You know,
he's like 76. And directing is a young 76? Man's game in terms of endurance and in terms of everything you have to do and oversee. And you know, he's in there hands-on and pretty much every part of it. He's pretty incredible.
So is it like putting out a novel a year? Is it that kind of feat here? I mean,
yeah.
Well, Dick Cavett said that at a party that they were at, Alan said to him, "Oh, I've got almost limitless ideas for movies." And that blew Cavett's mind because he said it would take me about a year to come up with one good idea for a movie. I mean, if you think about it, it's not easy to come up with three acts. And Alan does it year in and year out, and he does it with speed and generally with, you know, he's not putting out crap.
I was going to say, how many clunkers has he put out?
Oh, you know, I would say his output over the past 15 years has been uneven at best. But there have been some great movies in there, too. Look at Midnight in Paris. You know, sometimes he can still...
Was that a great film? It was a good film.
It was a great script. I thought it was a really good script. I thought it was very, very clever. I thought it had a lot of really, very human, nice touches. And you know, the whimsy of it. You know, when he's dealing with stuff that's a little bit whimsical, like Everyone Says I Love You or stuff like that, he still can find some good stuff. But whimsy is not the guarantee. The most sort of the lamest or the clunker of the four stories in Rome with Love is kind of the most whimsical one. So it's no guarantee, but in terms of the amount of stuff he's putting out and the overall arc in terms of quality, it's stunning.
And his films are always technically top-notch. And there's always something technically inventive and interesting, even though he's not a particularly technical filmmaker. He has a very clear style, and he uses it. You know, his genius is in his simplicity, his ability to set up a shot and maximize everything he can do within that frame with those actors and moving people in and out of the camera. And so his movies are always wonderful to look at. And his musical choices, you know, his love of jazz, his love of opera always makes for interesting music in the pictures. So, you know, there's been a few that have been kind of tough to get through. Yeah. And yet there's always something to watch, interesting going
of
on.
Of the films he has made in the Woody Allen canon, how many of those films will rank on the top 10, top 20 all-time American films? I mean, what are we looking at here?
I mean, I would think that certainly Annie Hall, Hannah and Her Sisters, Manhattan.
Crimes and Misdemeanors.
Maybe Crimes and Misdemeanors are you know, four absolutely, you know, indisputable
top 10,
classics.
Top 20.
I don't know if, you know, certainly top 10 comedies, Annie Hall would be on that list, I think. Mm-hmm. And as a director in terms of just body of work, he is one of the great American directors. He's one of the great international directors.
And he's regarded how in Hollywood in those circles?
I don't know about how in Hollywood, but I think the critical community would certainly
fawn all over,
say that he's a great filmmaker. He hasn't had to rely on Hollywood. That's been one of the interesting things. I mean, there's been times where he would have deals with companies like Orion, which was a very independent-minded company. Mm-hmm. He's made a couple of things for the studios. He had a huge relationship with United Artists for the longest time until they sort of went belly up. And, you know, and now he gets his financing from international. And it makes sense because the business of movie making is international anymore anyway. So it makes kind of sense that he's getting money from France. And he's a god in Europe. You know, it's the old jazz thing, right? We don't appreciate our jazz heroes, but of course in Europe everybody appreciates them.
He's dismissive utterly of awards programs like the Oscars.
Yeah, for Annie Hall, when it won four awards, including, I believe, Best Director, he didn't go there because he had his band that Monday night. He plays with his New Orleans jazz band, as they're called. He's an extremely talented, very hardworking clarinetist, and he plays every Monday night at the Carlisle in New York City, and the Oscars would have taken him out of the city. Now, that might have just been an excuse, or it might have been how committed he is to his band. I'm not really sure, but, you know, the Times, he read the next morning that it had, you know, that his movie had won four Oscars.
Mm-hmm. And I would argue that if you're a true artist who cares what the critics say? Yeah. I mean, your job as an artist is to make your art and to continue doing the work.
Just a couple more things. What percentage of his films has he appeared in himself?
More than half.
Than half. I mean, as he gets older, he becomes secondary characters often in the movies.
And is he in To Room with Love?
Yeah, yes. He's sort of the one of the main elements in sort of the clunker of a storyline, mm-hmm. the slower. And you know, he's still doing his shtick. You know, he's still doing the sort of frantic, put upon. What did Arthur Gelb of the New York Times called him? A slight, unhappy-looking, hunched-shouldered man with an air of harassment and carefully cultivated nebbish quality. Hmm. And he's kind of still – that's who he's always almost always
that
going to be.
That persona is amazing. And that is, of course, one of the true hallmarks of a movie star mm-hmm. is that you know, look at Out of the Past and Kirk Douglas's second film, and his Kirk Douglas persona was already there. And certainly you look at John Wayne, you know, when he started to make those early pictures with Ford, and he had this persona. And Woody Allen has had this neurotic, nebbish, overconfident, but tormented character yeah. who, you know, fancies himself a ladies' man and isn't. And then, of course, though, as his career progresses, he actually becomes a far more confident ladies' man in his movies. You know, whether it's believable or not, that persona sort of grows and changes.
And what kind of actor is he regarded as?
Well, as a director, he's regarded as a director who's an actor's director. In terms of an actor, I think he's actually pretty good. I certainly love him in movies like Manhattan. Mm-hmm. I think
he did
he's
the voice
genuine.
In Ants. He played an animated right. insect version of himself in that yeah. you know that
who had animated. Undergone psychoanalysis. Yeah. That's right. Yeah.
We are talking about great Woody Allen films with our DVD gurus. If you have a pick for your favorite, 816-235-2888. Our email address updatedate@kcur.org. Chris from Olathe. Good morning.
Hey, Steve. Great show.
Thanks.
Comment and a question. Hannah and Her Sister is by far, I think, one of Woody Allen's best films. My absolute favorite. I saw it when I was 11 years old, if you can believe that. Somebody can grasp Woody Allen at 11. But, you know, I love the character so much and the story. I mean, the characters and all their existential crises as they're going through, you know, I can certainly relate to. I think everybody can. But my question is this. Hollywood, as of late, has had a real penchant for remaking films. Just one example being like True Grit or something like that, like a classic, mm-hmm. and bringing it back. My question is it taboo to try to remake a Woody Allen film and bring kind of younger actors? I mean, a lot of people, you know, the younger generation may not know who Diane Wiest is or Mia Farrow, but, you know, could you stick to the story? But yet remake it with younger actors that I guess the younger generation can relate to now, because the stories are so great. I don't really think it's necessarily. I mean, it is in the acting, but the stories and the writing itself is so great. Could you remake a Woody Allen film and get away with it?
Interesting, Chris.
I guess there's two answers to that. The first is the practical one, which is, of course, probably no, because he controls his films and has controlled his movies since his very first film. He's had Final Cut, and he's owned and controlled all of his pictures. Mm-hmm. There's also a case to be made that Woody Allen is always remaking his own movies. You know, mm-hmm. he's doing his own mm-hmm. versions mm-hmm. of variations on the same themes and characters, and is using young new actors all the time. I mean, that's everybody wants to work with him. And you look at his relationship with Scarlett Johansson, for example, and the three pictures that they did together.
Mm-hmm.
So it's.
I mean, is he like his real life demeanor, or is he different? I mean, is the character in the movies how similar is it to what you see on screen?
Well, I mean, I know that in real life he's warm but painfully shy. Mm-hmm. He has been labeled as a bit of a hypochondriac. And a bit of a warrior.
I'm told he's into sports. He's very confident.
He loves Knicks basketball. You know, he is honestly one of the probably the best read directors out there. The guy is unbelievably intelligent. He devours books. He was in psychoanalysis for 37 years and found it an unbelievably useful thing.
Mm-hmm.
He stopped just about 1991, just about the time that the whole his family situation kind of dissolved in the scandal.
He sort of survived that.
He's survived and has apparently a very stable and loving relationship with Suni Previn, mm-hmm. who is now, I think, 47 years old. They've adopted two kids, and he's never looked back and has continued mm-hmm. making, honestly, some pretty great movies.
Well, speaking of pretty great movies, let's turn to first on Mitch Brine's list here. Annie Hall.
Which I suppose is the big turning point, the first big turning point in his career as a filmmaker, because he had prior to that made Take the Money and Run and Bananas and Everything You Always Wanted to Know About Sex and Love and Death, which were all pretty broad slapstick comedies, although certainly with Love and Death there's the existential crisis is beginning to emerge. It sort of makes fun of Bergman movies and Russian novels all at the same time. But he himself even called it his own kind of tribute to Bob Hope kind of comedies of this anachronistic character surrounded by these historical figures and reacting in a modern way. So when it came time to make Annie Hall, it really was a radical departure. And I can even remember as a kid, I think I was 16 or 17 when that movie came out, and seeing it and having loved Woody Allen movies already, realized that we were seeing something that was radically different. Mm-hmm. It was a film where he would move through time and space backwards and forward. He would address the camera directly. There's animation in it. There's subtitles to show us what characters are thinking versus what they're saying. I mean, it is a movie that embraces all of the tricks and magical things that movies can do and does it in this really unique, personal way. It's still a very funny movie, but he's clearly starting to deal with more dramatic issues. And so it's – the jokes are there, but it's not all a big construct for the jokes. The jokes begin to sort of creep their way into different moments and scenes.
Mm-hmm. And what did you think of it, Jason?
Woody Allen. Annie Hall is the turning point. It's where
what year is it made?
77.
I was going to say
77.
Yeah.
It's where he moves into some bigger ideas, some more genuinely human ideas that he looks at actual relationships, not necessarily. I mean, and yeah, Love and Death, you know, you've got the great Russian novels being sort of lampooned, but you know, Sleeper and things like that, they're gag movies. They're, you know, they're very slapsticky.
Speaking of Love and Death, Danny writes on Facebook about Love and Death, and he says, Diane Keaton says in the film, he has warmed the cockles of my heart about Woody Allen, to which Woody replies, just what I need, hot cockles.
That's right. Yeah, there's a lot of very goofy silliness that is not present in Annie Hall. Annie Hall, the laughs are more subtle. I mean, there's still some great one-liners. There's still some terribly funny moments in it, but the movie is – they're sort of incidental to a pretty great story that's being told.
He was 42 years old, which I think is also really
interesting. When he makes Annie Hall.
When he makes Annie Hall, and in a way, if that is that huge turning point where this real voice, artistic voice comes out, you know, and this willingness to address these bigger, deeper issues, it's interesting that, you know, he's been working for 20 years. He's been writing, you know, somebody once said he wrote his first joke at 17 and was never out of work ever since. Mm-hmm. He worked on great television shows. Then he spent in the 50s, and then he spent the 60s figuring out how to make movies. So by the time we get to the mid to late 70s, he's really sort of matured as an artist. And then the movies just come out, bam, 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 for the next 30 years.
Was Annie Hall really Diane Keaton's nickname as a child?
That I don't know.
That's what I've been told.
I heard it was Bluto, but I don't know. I heard it was a rugby nickname, but I don't know for sure.
Yeah. What's the clip we have for Annie Hall?
So it's a good way to start out. I mean, it begins with Woody Allen addressing the camera, addressing the audience directly. It sort of evokes his stand-up days, and it's an arresting, wonderful start to the picture, and that's what we've got here.
There's an old joke. Two elderly women are at a Catskill Mountain resort, and one of them says, "Boy, the food at this place is really terrible." The other one says, "Yeah, I know. And such small portions." Well, that's essentially how I feel about life. Full of loneliness and misery and suffering and unhappiness. And it's all over much too quickly. The other important joke for me is one that's usually attributed to Groucho Marx, but I think it appears originally in Freud's Wit and Its Relation to the Unconscious. And it goes like this, I'm paraphrasing. I would never want to belong to any club that would have someone like me for a member. That's the key joke of my adult life in terms of my relationships with women. You know, lately the strangest things have been going through my mind because I turned 40 and I guess I'm going through a life crisis or something. I don't know. And I'm not worried about aging. I'm not one of those characters, you know. Although I'm balding slightly on top. That's about the worst you can say about me. I think I'm going to get better as I get older. You know, I think I'm going to be the balding virile type, you know, as opposed to, say, the distinguished gray. For instance, you know, unless I'm neither of those two, unless I'm one of those guys with saliva dribbling out of his mouth who wanders into a cafeteria with a shopping bag screaming about socialism.
Just the idea of Woody Allen saying he's going to age well. Just an interesting idea. Okay. Let's turn to Jason Heck's first pick for his some of his favorite Woody Allen films. How about Manhattan?
How about Manhattan?
How about it?
It is I just got the Blu-ray of it, and I've been waiting and waiting and waiting because Blu-ray is sort of the format where movies will look their best, and Manhattan is, I think, his best-looking movie. It is absolutely It is decadent. It is lush. It is New York without any of the smell of urine or garbage or, you know, cabs honking or crazy people screaming or panhandlers. It is New York in black and white, as beautiful as it's ever looked. Mm. So after Annie Hall, he gets kind of carte blanche to make whatever he wants. And so he decides to take the chance and he makes Interiors in 1978, which is basically his version of a Bergman film. And it is completely serious. It is him not necessarily slavishly imitating Bergman, but it is his Bergman film. Then we get what is essentially, I think, as Goldfinger was kind of the quintessential right. Bond film, mm-hmm. Manhattan kind of starts us off in modern Woody Allen. He takes the seriousness that sort of imbued Annie Hall and he runs with it and tells a very interesting story about sort of two couples, sort of one couple that kind of switches around. It's he plays a 42-year-old TV writer who is a very successful writer on a comedy show, and he wants to write a book about New York. In fact, we start off with this beautiful montage to Gershwin, Rhapsody in Blue, of New York City with him giving this voiceover as he tries to come up with how to start this book about mm-hmm. New York City. He is a 42-year-old writer. He's twice divorced. He is dating a 17-year-old girl. And by dating, I mean that they are having a very normal peer-to-peer dating relationship. She is played by the unbelievably wonderful Meryl Hemingway, who grabbed herself an Oscar nom for it. Mm. She is, you know, he is a nervous 42-year-old Jewish TV writer. She is this ethereal, beautiful, very smart, very wise 17-year-old girl who is completely enamored with him. She says, "I'm in love with you." And he is constantly saying, "Listen, this is fun. This is great. It's a fling. At some point, you'll need to date a guy your age named Biff or Scooter or Billy, and you'll need to move on." His best friend, played by Michael Murphy, is a guy named Yale. And Yale and his wife, Ellen, I believe is her name, Emily, excuse me, have what seems to be a great marriage, except Yale reveals that he has been seeing another woman named Mary Wilkie, and she is played by Diane Keaton, who was Allen's, you know, Mia Farrow is the middle period muse. Allen was the, Keaton was his early period muse. And it's a great role. She is, okay, so he kind of becomes torn between this sort of neurotic, very pretentious, very smart woman and his wonderful ethereal 17-year-old girl, and he, you know, he kind of thinks he's making the right call when he breaks up with the 17-year-old in a very actually pretty poignant scene, and throws in with Mary Wilkie, and turns out that that's maybe not the best idea he's ever had. The movie is gorgeous to look at. This marked his second collaboration with Gordon Willis. Willis shot Annie Hall, right?
Yeah.
Who was a cinematographer known as the Prince of Darkness because of his amazing use of shadows. And the movie is so beautiful to look at. It is almost every shot is something that you could sort of pause and put in a frame on your wall. And they're you know, things that look right out of Bergman, things that look right out of Edward Hopper. It is so gorgeous to look at. And of course, the Gershwin music is the movie's other big character. It is a huge component of the film.
Well, you're selling it so well.
Annie Hall is certainly more iconic and more famous. It is sort of because it was this big turning point and it grabbed a passel of Oscars. But for me, Manhattan is a film that resonates with me a little bit more. I feel it a little bit more in my bones than I do Annie Hall.
He didn't like that one, right?
And yeah, the fascinating part is when it was over, he hated it. He said, he said to United Artists, "I will make a film for you for free if you don't release Manhattan." And audiences flocked to Manhattan. It made $39 million. So in 77, you know, it wasn't Star Wars money, but it was doing okay.
Yeah.
So it's a movie that holds up very, very well because, shooting it in black and white kind of eliminates, you know, any goofiness that 70s fashion or 70s cars or whatever might kind of get to pull you out of this fugue, this sort of in love-ness that you're supposed to feel for New York. And you do. It's you know, it's Bergdorf and
is
galleries.
Is this the first
and,
film he makes that he's sort of making as an ode to some place?
Yeah, I would say so. Yeah. And also, it's a great performance from Meryl Streep as his second ex-wife, who's on the verge of writing a tell-all book about their marriage that is just going to humiliate and embarrass him and talk about all of his foibles and neuroses and what a screwed-up mess he is.
What's the clip we have?
This is a great clip. This is Isaac. This is Woody Allen and Meryl Hemingway there walking through a grocery store after having just met Diane Keaton's character, who came off as a terrible cultural snob, and Woody Allen does not like that at all.
From Manhattan.
What a creep. Could you believe her? I mean, she was really
nervous.
She was overbearing. She was, you know, terrible. She was all cerebral. You know, it was all, what the hell is a little Radcliffe Tootsie come off raiding Scott Fitzgerald and Gustav Mahler and then Heinrich Boll?
I understand why you're getting so mad.
I'm mad because I don't like that pseudo-intellectual garbage. Van Gogh. Did you hear that? She said Van Gogh. I could, like an Arab, she spoke. I could, and if she had made one more remark about Bergman, I would have knocked her other contact lens out.
What is she as mistress?
That will never cease to mystify me. And he's got a wonderful wife, and he prefers to diddle this little yo-yo that you know, and, but he was always a sucker for those kind of women, you know, the kind that would involve him in discussions of existential reality, you know? They'd probably sit around on the floor with wine and cheese and mispronounce allegorical and didacticism.
Well, I get the feeling that Yale really likes it.
Well, I'm old-fashioned. I don't believe in extramarital relationships. I think people should mate for life, like pigeons or Catholics.
And that's so, you know, Manhattan. You see the maturity of this girl, though, who says, is she Yale's mistress? Very normally, you know. Mm-hmm. So the movie does not – this 17-year-old girl is a big part of it, and she is not talked down to. She is not held up as something, you know, very, mm-hmm. very childlike or naive or innocent. She's just sort of a little bit – maybe a little bit cleaner than the people around her. But it's great.
We're talking about great Woody Allen films. Let's go to Dan from Overland Park. Dan, good morning.
Good morning. I wanted to mention my favorite Woody Allen movie, which is Crimes and Misdemeanors.
Yeah.
And I think I like it the best because it's such a moral story. I think a lot of people see Woody Allen's movies and know they're funny, but maybe they're a little sort of postmodern,
mm-hmm.
morally bankrupt. But in fact, he's making a lot of important statements in that movie about right and wrong. And it's a pretty dark story because bad people do not get punished.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Alan Alda plays this really despicable producer who enjoys a lot of success, and that's my favorite Woody Allen movie. Someone was saying earlier about how he seems to be able to get everybody to be in his movie.
Yeah, no kidding. No
Angelica Houston's in that movie, and a lot of important people.
Yeah, Dan, thank you. How does Crimes and Misdemeanors rank?
It's one of his very best. Martin Landau's performance is absolutely amazing.
Yeah.
In that movie.
Okay, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our good conversation here with our DVD gurus about great Woody Allen films. We're talking with Mitch Bryan and Jason Heck. When we come back, we'll turn to Husbands and Wives, Stardust Memories, Match Point, and Zelig. And this is from where, this music?
This is from Wild Man Blues, the documentary about him playing clarinet.
Okay, sounds good. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. And we are back. I'm Steve Kraske. If you missed our talk about George H.W. Bush yesterday, you can find it, plus the weekend to-do list and all of our previous broadcasts at kcur.org. Tomorrow on the program, a look. I don't know what we're doing on the program on Monday. We'll get there in just a few minutes. Okay, we're visiting with our DVD gurus, Mitch Bryan and Jason Heck. We're talking about great Woody Allen films. Let's move on here. Mitch Bryan, tell us about Husbands and Wives.
Husbands and Wives was made in 1992. It was the first picture that Woody Allen did for a different studio. Did it for Orion, with whom he had a long, fruitful relationship. He did it for TriStar. My mistake. And It's an amazing movie for a couple of reasons. First, it's a typical Woody Allen movie in the sense that it's coming back to those same themes. It starts with two couples, one couple played by Judy Davis and Sidney Pollack, the other by Woody Allen and Mia Farrow, And couple number one comes to visit couple number two only to tell them and shock them with the news that they're going to get a divorce. And Woody Allen and Mia Farrow are completely shocked by what they thought was this perfect marriage, and Pollock and Davis have decided they're going to go their separate ways. So the story will bounce back and forth between these people. Meanwhile, Woody Allen's character starts to have this potential relationship with a young student. Again, the theme of the older man, younger woman comes back. Mm-hmm. But what's really interesting about this movie is that up to this point, Woody Allen's style had been one where the camera was more or less locked down, where characters would move in and out of frame. And this film takes on essentially the faux documentary reality TV language system. In 1992, I mean, we're talking about, you know, 20 years ago, the language system that we see now every time we turn television on, with scenes and then characters talking into camera, explaining their actions, you know, mm-hmm. that kind of picture. He made a movie 20 years ago using that very style. And it just shows sort of how much he is attuned to where media is. And when the movie came out, in fact, some of the critics were saying, oh, the camera is so shaky and it's moving around and you know, we've never seen anything like that before. Well, so it's fascinating because on one hand, you're getting this language system of the documentary, but you're seeing very private moments that couldn't possibly really be being covered by the documentary crew, the same way as The Office. The Office does the exact same thing, for example. But it's a remarkable movie. It's very mature in the sense that it really is trying to grapple with the inherent promises and disillusionment that potentially goes along with any long-term married relationship. The fact of how hard it is to keep a marriage together, the challenges, the allure of somebody outside the marriage. And so you've got this one marriage that's holding together, this other one that's broken apart, and then both of those couples, both of those members of that first relationship go out and find other mates. Liam Neeson shows up as this really sweet, solid guy who starts to romance Judy Davis, who is absolutely neurotically out of her mind and can't seem to accept what's coming her way in terms of this great guy. And it is – the scenes between them are so unbelievably funny and painful all at the same time, as you see these two characters who cannot seem to get out of their own way so that the relationship itself can move ahead.
Mm-hmm.
And the film is noteworthy, I suppose, from an historical point of view, because this was the film that was being made, you know, when Woody Allen's relationship with Mia Farrow fell apart in a very dramatic fashion. She found out that he was, you know, having a relationship with her adopted daughter. Mm-hmm. And in fact –
That's the woman he married, right?
That's Sunya Previa.
Yeah, right.
But I think what's – and apparently I didn't know this, but I recently found out because of an amazing documentary that's running – streaming on Netflix now, that was part of the American Masters series about Woody Allen. That's
a good series, by the way.
Yeah, it's a great series.
Yeah.
And that the final breakup scene took place after she had made this discovery about him. And so she didn't come into work for a few days, and they sort of had to say, we got to finish the film and you got to come in and you guys have to act together. And you know, it must have been a very, very difficult thing to do. They soldiered on like professionals, and the film has a very poignant, powerful ending. It's a great movie. It's tough sometimes, you know. It's a little hard to watch in places, but it is filmmaking by a very serious, very talented, very committed filmmaker.
What's the clip we got here?
So this is a clip towards the end of the picture when we're starting to see the rift that's developing between the relationship between Woody Allen's character and Mia Farrow's character.
Okay, this is from Husbands and Wives.
I went back into psychotherapy.
Jesus, you're kidding. You don't need psychotherapy, and certainly not with her.
You're just threatened by her because she's postmodern.
Listen, anyone who writes a paper suggesting the Sabine women had it coming to them...
That's not it.
Jesus. I do not flirt.
Don't tell me you don't flirt, because I've seen you do it at parties. You put on a whole other personality.
Oh, you're crazy.
Of course you do. You get all soulful and pretend to want things that you really can't stand.
Like what? What are you talking about?
Like moving to Europe. That's just a flirting technique. You couldn't survive off the island of Manhattan for more than 48 hours.
Let me tell you, you're the one that misrepresented herself when we got married.
What do you mean by that? Like what?
Like what? Like you had one child and then, you know, you didn't want any more? That was plenty?
Yes, that's the way I felt then. People change. I'm not the same person I was all those years ago.
Well, that's why relationships go sour.
Yeah, you hate change.
Sure, I hate change equals death.
Mm. Yeah. you get a pretty good idea there, don't you?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. Again, that's Mitch Bryan talking about Husbands and Wives. We're talking this morning about very good Woody Allen films. If you want to join our conversation with your pick for one or two of your favorites, 816-235-2888, our email address, update@kcur.org, or go to KCUR's Facebook page. Okay, Jason Heck, up next with a film, Stardust Memories.
Yeah, the great critic cinema writer F.X. Feeney said that after Manhattan, audiences were ready to follow Woody anywhere except Stardust Memories. It is Allen regards this as one of his three best films, along with Match Point and The Purple Rose of Cairo. Mitch and I visited Stardust Memories last night, and it's a very, very interesting film. It is his Fellini film.
This is
1980.
Mm-hmm.
This was basically a remake of Eight and a Half, of Fellini's Eight and a Half, which is sort of about a put-upon film director, and he's sort of fobbing off producers and beautiful women and fans. And here we have Allen as a film director who is basically at a retrospective of his films. And he is trying to develop a new film, which is, like Fellini's film, being regarded as extremely, extremely ambitious. And so studio suits are kind of wanting to take it away from him and rewrite it. And he is being, you know, no, you can't take my script. And the movie has a lot of dreamlike qualities to it. Allen makes this deliberate. There are scenes where we think we're seeing reality, but all of a sudden it's revealed that they're actors who are acting in a movie or in a dream of his. Or, you know, we think we're seeing reality when suddenly a Bigfoot attack somebody, and that's the Bigfoot is representative of his anger and rage.
Mm-hmm.
There's a scene where he apparently gets killed, shot and killed by a fan, but the death is only temporary. It's not an easy movie to approach. It's a very personal film for him, and a lot of people were very offended by it because it appears that he is very directly attacking his fans. This character that he plays, who is kind of a guy who is a comedy director who wants to make more serious movies. This seems a lot like Woody Allen himself. When he's at this retrospective, he is besieged by these fans, and Allen must have sent his casting director. Mitch and I were looking at these people, and they're shot up close with very unflattering lenses, and every single one of them looks weird in some way. They have a giant nose, or they have giant eyebrows, or their face isn't quite right, or part of them looks like it's melting.
This is very Fellini-like.
Right. It's very dreamlike, but it's also this guy's fans pestering him for autographs. And people, you know, Allen's fans, a lot of them took it as a very direct attack, you know. And one person, you know, who is sort of shown to be needlessly overanalyzing one of his movies, you know, I'm sure a lot of film scholars kind of felt that they were taking it right on the chin. And Allen said he regretted that because he didn't want that to be interpreted as such. He said, you know, there are chunks of the movie that seem very autobiographical. Mitch and I were talking about this at the beginning of right before the show. You know, there are big parts of Woody Allen in a lot of Woody Allen movies, but none of them are completely autobiographical. And that was sort of a leap that a lot of critics made. They said, you know, this is Woody Allen making a movie of himself, about himself, by himself. And it isn't. He has said that it's not autobiographical. There are a lot of things that touch on his career, but it's not. And it sort of sharply divided people. Gordon Willis shot it for him. It's black and white. It was shot in all of these sort of crumbling seaside resort towns on the New Jersey shore. And it's very beautiful to look at. They found some amazing locations. But it is not an easy movie to get inside. It is sort of, while Manhattan was easy to personally relate to, like we all knew about falling in love with the right person or the wrong person, or we all knew about infidelity. You know, it was tough. This was a very personal movie for him, and that made it very hard for an audience to relate to, and thus it was kind of a bomb. I'm glad I saw it. I wanted to try something of his that I hadn't. Like I said, the aesthetic of it is very beautiful, but it is definitely a movie that does not provide many easy answers. But I'm definitely glad I saw it, and I get why he would regard it as one of his best, because there is a lot of stuff in there that clearly meant a lot to him, that was clearly a personal. The movie sort of in a lot of ways almost feels kind of like a magic trick. And, you know, there's sort of, you know, when he does the big reveal, the audience was kind of like, It's not enough. But yeah. It's gorgeous to look at and has a terrific, terrific soundtrack of really good old jazzy stuff that's like a lot of Louis Armstrong in it doing Stardust. And it's really good in that respect.
What's the clip we have from this Stardust Memories?
This clip is actually the producers, all the studio suits, have just seen the first 4 minutes of his new film, which is actually the intro to the Stardust Memories itself, and boy, do they not like it. And this kind of gives us a little insight into what he's battling.
Well, I thought it was terrible. Absolutely terrible. I don't recall seeing anything
this
bad.
This man is sick. I mean, what is this?
I thought this was supposed to be a comedy. That was Seagulls, the most horrifying thing I've ever seen.
That's horrible.
This is a disgrace. Hey, he has no balance left. Listen, I think the guy's losing
somebody
his mind.
Somebody please cut that projector.
Something wrong with him.
Well,
he's out of balance.
Sad. What are we
going to do? Really nothing.
$12 million for that garbage?
Okay,
what's self-indulgence?
Let's not panic.
I think the man's lost his mind.
Look, we can take the film away from him. We can reshoot it. We can recut it. Maybe we can salvage something.
Pretentious. His filming style is too fancy. His insights are shallow and morbid. I've seen it all before. They try to document their private suffering and fob it off as art.
What does he have to suffer about? Doesn't the man know he's got the greatest gift that anyone can have, the gift of laughter?
So there were a lot of people who, and they say it in this movie, but who said it to Woody Allen after he started making movies like Interiors. I loved your early films, you know, the funny ones. And so that's what this director's taking it. You know, he's doing this Q&A with this audience who's asking him, you know, why don't you make these funny movies anymore? Or what are you trying to say with this new one?
We're talking about great Woody Allen films. Dave from Kansas City, Missouri, welcome. You there, Dave? Let's go to Joe from Shawnee. Joe, you're on Up to Date.
Hi. I've missed the first 40 minutes of the show, so I don't know if you've already talked about this.
Don't ever do that again, Joe.
I promise.
Yeah.
And I, you know, be honest, I don't know a lot of Woody Allen movies, but I watched one that I thought was just fantastic. I've actually watched it a couple times since then, and I don't know. It's Manhattan Murder Mystery, and I don't know where it ranks in pantheon of Woody Allen movies, but it was just a funny movie with Diane Keaton and Alan Alda and a great murder mystery plot line, and Woody didn't want to get involved at all in his wife's obsession of this murder that they thought happened in the apartment next to him. And by the end of the movie, he's completely obsessed with it and becomes a hero to his wife.
I believe it was 1993, and it's a very typical Allen movie in a lot of ways. It's one of his middling films, not great, but certainly nowhere near at the bottom of the list.
Joe, thanks for the call. I appreciate it. Yeah, bye-bye. Mitch Bryan, Match Point.
Match Point was made in 2005, and it sort of came at the tail end of a period where Woody Allen's movies were sort of uneven. Early 90s, there were some strong things, and then he began to go in some different directions, and you never quite knew what you were going to get, which is good, I think. But when Match Point came along, it was a really extraordinary boost. It did very well at the box office. Critics liked it. It surprised everybody. And it essentially is, in some ways, a reworking of the serious half of Crimes and Misdemeanors, in the sense that it is another return to some of the themes of Crime and Punishment and the notion of, of murder, a criminal solution to a domestic problem. And it follows the exploits of a former tennis professional tennis player who's now become a teacher, tennis teacher at a country club, Irish fellow played by Johnny Rhys-Meyers, who manages to sort of ingratiate himself to an upper class family. The daughter falls in love with him. They ultimately get married, and into this life comes Scarlett Johansson, this absolutely radiant, beautiful, sexy girlfriend of his brother-in-law's, and eventually they launch into this torrid, passionate affair, which ultimately gets completely out of control and forces, you know, our young hero to decide whether or not he's going to kill her. So it's serious. It's a thriller. There's not many jokes in the picture. It's certainly Woody Allen's voice is there all through it, embodied by these other actors. But it's sexy and it's vibrant, and it's the tension just sort of intensifies step by step by step, and it's really one of his best movies.
What did he say about why he made a film like this?
That's a good question.
Yeah, you wonder.
I don't know. I mean,
mindset.
It was one of his first movies when he moved out of the country. That's one of the big things that has marked his last, you know, half dozen pictures is that he left New York and he went to Europe and started making films in Europe. And this is one of the
three. He lives in Europe today?
I don't know. I don't know if he lives there, but he's made three movies in England, and one in France. He just finished the one in Rome. So, and one in Barcelona as well. So he's made six movies overseas. And in some ways, it seemed to reinvigorate him as an artist, having these new metropolitan landscapes to treat with the same, you know, the same romance and interest that he treated New York. But they're different.
Yeah, there was a thing in the documentary. The guy said, you know, he's shot every street corner in New York. And, you know, what else is left to show there? And apparently it's a lot cheaper to make movies.
And his financing is coming from Europe as well, which I'm sure with To Rome with Love, that explains why half of the cast is Italian. Mm-hmm. Half of the film is in Italian. It was shot in Italy. It's probably financed.
Benigni.
What's the clip we have here?
So this is a dinner discussion between the four main characters and the typical philosophical dilemma of Woody Allen's characters.
Have you done many movies?
It was a commercial, not a movie.
But your eyes went straight to it, if you know what I mean.
I don't think my career has really gone as planned.
Well, you just need a break.
I think it's important to be lucky in anything.
Well, I don't believe in luck. I believe in hard work.
Oh, hard work is mandatory, but I think everybody's afraid to admit what a big part luck plays. I mean, it seems scientists are confirming more and more that all existence is here by blind chance. No purpose, no design.
Well, I don't care. I love every minute of it.
And I envy you for it.
What was it the vicar used to say? Despair is the path of least resistance. It was something odd, wasn't it? It was very.
I think that faith is the path of least resistance.
Oh, God.
Oh God. Can we change the subject, please? Nola was talking about acting, which is much more interesting.
And who's in that scene?
That was Emily Morton, Scarlett Johansson, Johnny Rhys Meyers, and Matthew Good.
Okay, that's from Match Point. Okay, the final Woody Allen movie on the list today. Jason Heck, you want to go with Zelig.
I do want to go with it. Do you want me to go with it?
I do.
Let's do it. Zelig, 1983, coming right after Midsummer Night's Sex Comedy, which was sort of his return to his comedic roots after Stardust Memories kind of alienated a lot of people. And then, of course, coming right before The Purple Rose of Cairo, which is certainly one of his best films. Zelig is completely fascinating. It's actually a charming movie. It was shot in a documentary style that
Technically, he is all over the place, isn't he?
When he gets an idea, he is technically proficient enough to run with it.
Yeah.
And he surrounds himself with really good technicians in that respect. And in this case, it's also Gordon Willis, his cinematographer. But it's a look back at the 1920s heyday of a man named Leonard Zelig, who is also known as the human chameleon, and has a preternatural gift or psychotic condition or illness that allows him to take on the physical characteristics of those people around him. So if you put him in a room with a bunch of fat guys, he'll gain 200 pounds. If you put him next to a Chinese guy, he'll start to develop Asian features. It's a completely interesting movie that looks at sort of our relationship with fame and how we treat our celebrities. It looks at him at sort of the height of his power in the 20s. He's observed at a party by F. Scott Fitzgerald, who notes that Zelig relates to the affluent guests in this thick, refined accent and shares their Republican sympathies. But while he's in the kitchen with the servants, he adopts a ruder tone and seems to be more of a Democrat. So F. Scott Fitzgerald first notices this. But It's great. Mia Farrow plays his psychiatrist named Dr. Eudora Fletcher, who's sort of trying to cure him and sort of get him out there and sort of show her peers in the field that this incredible man who, when he is put in a bunch of room with psychiatrists, begins talking just like a psychiatrist. Mm-hmm. And it's technically it's actually incredible. 11 years before Forrest Gump, Allen's using blue screen to blend himself in to old newsreel footage of Babe Ruth and Hermann Göring and Pope Pius and Hitler. And they did this thing where they actually went out. He and Gordon Willis went out and got these old cameras and with old lenses. And Gordon Willis at one point was showering with the negatives and stomping on them in his shower to kind of get the footage all chewed up and screwed up. And it's fascinating. It clocks in shorter than most of his films. In fact, almost every Woody Allen movie is 90 minutes plus or minus 30 seconds. Mitch and I were noticing last night. But in fact, this one's actually about 78 minutes. And it came in, the original cut was 45, because there isn't that much to say, really. And so he had to pad it with all this documentary footage. But it's actually a very funny movie. It's a very poignant film. And technically, it's a tour de force. And like Mitch was saying, he's not a guy who plays with a lot of effects trickery or anything like that. But when it serves his storytelling purpose, he is as adept as he needs to be mm-hmm. with whatever he's doing. And this one, like I said, 11 years before Forrest Gump wowed us by putting, you know, Tom Hanks in the frame with President Kennedy, he's doing it in a very adept and very cool way.
What's the clip we got?
This is Calvin Turner, a waiter at a speakeasy, who is describing an early encounter with Leonard Zelig.
Present that evening was Calvin Turner, a waiter.
And a lot of customers, a lot of gangsters come into the place because they're always good tippers and take good care of us. And, of course, we try to take care of our customers. But on this particular night, I looked over, and here's a strange guy coming in. I'd never seen him before. So I asked one of the other, I said, John, do you know this guy? You ever seen him? So he looks. I said, no, I ain't never seen him before, man. I don't know who he is, but I know one thing. He's a tough-looking hombre. So I looked over, and then next thing, the guy had disappeared. I don't know where he went to. But about this time, you know, the music gets started. And the band started driving, playing. I looked, and here's a guy, a colored guy in the bar, a colored boy over there playing trumpet. Man, he was playing back. Then I looked at the guy, and I said, well, my goodness, he looks just like that gangster. But the gangster was white, and this guy is black. So I don't know what's happening.
So, yeah, that's the amazing human chameleon, Leonard Zelig.
RB from Kansas City, Missouri, what's your favorite Woody Allen film? Just go quick, RB.
My favorite was Annie Hall, but I was telling your screener, I think Woody Allen, like Mel Brooks, they're both great in what they do. I don't think there'll ever be a Woody Allen movie that will encompass the decades like Gone with the Wind or Casablanca, yeah. Even though he's great.
Yeah. RB, good phone call. We've got to wrap it up. I'm sorry we can't get to John, Chris, or Patrick, all from Kansas City, Missouri. Jason and Mitch, thanks again.
Thank you.
See you later.
Good way to spend an hour. Our DVD gurus are Mitch Bryan and Jason Heck. You'll find a complete list of today's films and more information about our show at kcur.org. Don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook and this program on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. Next week on The Big Show, we'll look at current developments in area development, Code for America, and fast food in hospitals. Our show's theme music, typically, not today, is by Bobby Watson and the UMKC Conservatory of Music Concert Jazz Band. We had help this week from KCUR's Danny Alexander, Greta Wendelin, and Kim Noble. Our show is produced by Steven Steigman. Have a great weekend, all. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you are up to date.